This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I am Meera Sivasodhi. This month on Brainwaves, neurogeneticist Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar shares how scientists are planning to edit memories and delete bad ones that trigger anxiety and post-traumatic stress. Sounds too good to be true. I know. I wish I could actually erase a lot of my memories. It's already been carried out in snails. How close are we humans to snails? Well, we'll find out. Welcome to the show, Dr. Azlina.
Hi, Meera. Hi. We missed you the last show.
Yes, we did indeed. Yeah. But, you know, happy to have you back. And
yes.
What more talking about memories?
Yes.
Something very, very close to my heart, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
So scientists in the US have said that there is a possibility of editing our memories to make them less traumatic. How does that work?
Yeah, actually, it's with the advent of latest technology. It's called optogenetics. A very kind of fancy word, but basically what it is you create special mice that have modified neurons that can respond to bursts of light. So let's say if you wanted to activate that neuron, you just shine a laser beam on them and that neuron will be activated. And so how they can do it is you can actually target then selected neurons that you know are involved in a particular kind of memory. And then if you want to create the memory, you kind of shine the light on and a memory will be created, so to speak. And then after that, if you kind of want to, modify it or manipulate it, then you can kind of do a number of other changes.
Yeah. When you say shine the light,
yeah.
You're talking about shining the light from the outside?
No, so in mice, they would have implanted these electrodes. In the brain, that's right. So I guess it's similar to, like Men in Black.
Yes.
You remember when they wanted, when there was an alien in the midst of the human, and then they wanted the humans to forget, and then they would sort of whip out this sort of magic wand, and then they would kind of click on it and this light would just sort of turn on and everybody would forget. So it's sort of similar to that kind of
theory.
Idea. Yeah.
Okay. But just to take a step back, could you explain to us how our memories actually work?
Yeah. So memories are actually formed when neurons kind of are activated together. So if you have, let's say, a neuron that fires because it has been stimulated by something, and then you have another neuron that is activated at the same time, then you have changes that happen at the synapse where the two neurons communicate with each other. And over time, if you repeatedly stimulate them in the same way, so they must be activated at the same time, then they will form a kind of physical, they will change, the actual synapses will change. So you will form stronger synapses, stronger connection between those neurons. And so that is sort of the idea behind memory formation.
Okay. And yeah. But it needs to be activated over and over.
Yeah, that's right. So, if you think about learning how to play ping pong or tennis, right? At first, you don't really know how to swing your arm and, you don't know the strength at which you need to hit the ball. But over time, once you kind of, you keep reactivating those motor neurons in your arm, you activate the same muscle. So those two are kind of activated at the same time. So you create a stronger connection between them. So a sort of memory is formed in that sense. In this case, it would be a motor memory. So over time, the more and more you practice, that movement becomes smoother because you can activate, say, that one cell, and then it will then go on and activate all the other cells that have sort of formed this connection. So that's what is good with practice, And similarly, if other things, like if you're trying to learn a verse or if you're trying to study something, you need to kind of do it repetitively. And that kind of helps in the connections becoming stronger.
Why is it some people don't have to put in as much effort as the others to remember?
Yes, I know.
do they have special neurons and synapses that, stronger than ours?
That's the thing. Memory is actually, I've sort of explained it. It sounds simple, right? And, you just have to activate this neuron and another neuron and, voila, you have a memory. But it's not, a lot of things need to happen as well. So, for example, things like attention, your emotional state. So if you were to think of what are the events that have the strongest memory, you know, a lot of the time they have an emotional connection. And that is because, you know, when you are experiencing that, you know, your neurons are at a, say, heightened active state. And so the part of the brain which is involved in memories and the part of the brain that is involved in encoding emotion, they're kind of, you know, talking to each other very strongly at that point. So then that helps then in the memory formation because you have greater number of cells that are activated at the same time, so to speak.
So it involves different parts of the brain?
Yeah, yeah. So actually memory is not just stored at one part of the brain. You many different parts of the brain store different types of memories. So you have motor memory, which is normally at the cerebellum. Then you have like spatial memory, like what we spoke about a few episodes ago, which is stored in the hippocampus. And then you have visual memory, like, you know, you look at an A and you know it's an A. Yeah. You have olfactory memory, you know, all sorts, memory of reward pathways and emotional memory. And actually there was, and how we know this is actually from a case study that was done many years ago by a man called Henry Mollison. And he actually, when he was younger, he suffered from epilepsy. And a radical kind of surgery was done on him whereby the doctors removed both sides of his temporal lobe, which is sort of near where your ears would be. And what they found was that after the surgery, he couldn't form new memories. And he couldn't remember anything that happened a year before his surgery. So he could remember his childhood quite well, but he couldn't kind of remember sort of more recent events, and he couldn't form new memories. So the doctors and the nurses that he met after the surgery, he would sort of greet them as if it was somebody that he met, you know, new every day. And so leading up to his story was that the scientists didn't quite understand how memory storage was within the brain. And so when the subsequent studies were done on him, they found that he had a problem with making new what they call episodic memory. So he couldn't remember events. He couldn't remember people and names within a particular episode or an event that he went through in his life. But if you asked him to play ping pong, you know, over time, he actually improved. So the memory that helped him improve his motor skills was kept in a different part of the brain, which wasn't removed. And so that was one of the important discoveries that came about from his studies. And he is a well-known patient in neuroscience. Yeah.
So his temporal lobe is the one that controls quite a lot of stuff that he couldn't remember.
Yeah. Okay. So he couldn't form new memories because of the lack of the hippocampus.
Temporal lobe. Yeah. The hippocampus sits in the temporal lobe.
That's right.
Okay. Yeah. And how much of it is genetic?
Please say
quite a lot.
I think with anything, you know, I mean, genetics has a role to play. But it's also how you have been trained as well, I think. Like I mentioned, your emotional state when you're kind of experiencing something is a big deal. So I always say to my students, I said, the worst thing you can do when you're studying or learning something is not to care about something. Because if you don't care about something, then it's actually harder to learn. So, you know, a particularly boring lecture or something like that, it's difficult to kind of think back. But if you think about, you know, episodes where you had a lot of fun or where you were very upset, then it's easier, you know, to recall those memories. And so I said, you know, as I tell my students, jokingly, of course, I said, you know, you can either really love me or my classes or really hate my classes. Either way, just don't be a person who doesn't care about the classes, because then that doesn't help in how you remember them. Yeah.
Why is it then we remember bad memories? Why is it bad memories stay with us for such a long time?
Because they have this very strong emotional connection. Yeah. And, you know, anything emotional or anything that gives you a sense of reward or pleasure will also form very strong memories. So, you know, something that if you went to a shop and the shop had the best chocolates ever, you know, you will remember because it was a pleasurable experience. So your brain will kind of remember, okay, I need to go back to that shop. That shop was great, you know. But if you went to a restaurant and that restaurant gave you food poisoning, you would also need to remember that. Forming a memory is also kind of related to very strongly to an emotional. So, you know, you can smell cologne or talcum powder or soap from your grandmother's bathroom. And you remember that for years, you know, because you not only perhaps you were repeatedly exposed to it, but because it carries such an emotional bond.
You know what I remember the most?
Mm.
The smell of our school toilets. It's still so fresh in my memory.
Oh, dear.
I hope it doesn't smell the same for everybody's sake.
You're kind of, you know? Just saying that is kind of evoking that smell. And I can almost smell it. Yeah. All school toilets smell the same.
I'm sure they did.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. We're discussing memory editing in our Brainwaves series. Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, neurogeneticist in the studio with me. When we come back, we'll find out more about how, you know, you can actually edit this memory, more so when it triggers anxiety and post-traumatic stress disorders. On The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. We are on our 9th episode of Brainwaves and we're discussing memory editing with Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, a neurogeneticist. Dr. Azlina, just before we go into the whole memory editing topic, why is it that our memory declines with age?
Well, there are many theories as to why it could be. Number one is that, as I mentioned, to form these memories, the neurons need to make connections with each other. So as we age physiologically, perhaps the neurons are unable to kind of do that fast enough. That's partly because as we age, we also accumulate damage in our DNA. So perhaps some of that damage is sort of making it difficult to make the proteins that we need to make these connections, these new connections. So it's harder then to kind of, you know, make these new synapses, so to speak. Another kind of possibility is there's a different group who's sort of saying that it's not that we can't make the memories, but it's just we're having a trouble retrieving them or recalling them. So there was a study that they were saying that they sort of likened a person with an elderly brain in the sense that it's a filing cabinet full of files that you've sort of accumulated through the years, right? And the problem is that, you know, how do you sort of find the file that you need quickly? And so they sort of said the file is there. So meaning the memory is there, it's just the retrieval process is altered. And actually there was some recent data that sort of suggested that if you did it in mice that had this problem in were genetically engineered to have Alzheimer's disease, and if you looked at them early in Alzheimer's disease, you would find that they could actually form the memories, but then if you asked them to retrieve it days later, they were unable to behave in the way that indicated that they could retrieve that memory. So that suggests that there is some support for this kind of retrieval process. You know, it's a problem kind of studying an aging brain because there are many things that are happening at the same time. You know, you have some sort of perhaps some chemical changes in the brain, you know, and especially in very elderly people, you may have sort of these mini strokes that might be happening, which are not clearly perceptible to us, but there might be sort of, you know, small damages in, you know, clusters of neurons that sort of needed to talk to other clusters of neurons. And now because they're damaged, they no longer can. And so then, you know, that's when you have a problem with perhaps remembering the word for a particular item. You know, you go, what's that word again? You know, you can't remember how to do, you know, the actual word. So it could be that, you know, those cells just aren't able to communicate as well.
A death of brain cell.
Yeah, I mean, could be partly due to death of brain cells. Like I said, there are many different things that could happen, not just one thing.
Okay. Yeah. And we all experience death of brain cell as we age, isn't it? What about lifestyle? Does that affect our memory? Let's talk about alcohol.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, alcohol would affect memory in the sense that you would probably enhance memory for the brand of alcohol that you most enjoyed because the alcohol itself will activate the part of the brain which gives you a reward. So you would get pleasure from drinking, say, that brand of beer compared to another brand of beer. So you would associate this particular brand of beer with, you know, greater pleasure. So on one hand, you know, that's how it would affect the pleasurable memory part of the brain. But also, you know, there are many things that the alcohol can also affect other parts of the brain. It can dampen a certain neuronal activity so that you find that you cannot recall the previous night's events as clearly as you would have if, say, you hadn't taken alcohol, because, you know, it sort of interferes with that process of retrieval, so to speak. So it's not that the memory wasn't made. It's just really, you know, it's like you feel fuzzy, you know.
It's harder to recall.
It's harder to recall, yeah, because your brain is, I guess, intoxicated to such an extent that, you know, it can't kind of focus on those memories to be strengthened.
So what about smoking?
Smoking, again, you know, you would form an associative memory with the pleasurable brand of cigarettes. Now, some people say that because the part of the brain, how the brain is activated by smoking is you have this acetylcholine and nicotine, because the nicotine in the cigarettes will activate a particular pathway known as the cholinergic or acetylcholine receptors in the brain. And so these acetylcholine receptors are scattered all over the brain, some of which are in these sort of memory areas. So there have been, you know, if you ask people who smoke, if you ask them anecdotally, you know, how do you feel? Why is it that you smoke? And then they feel that, well, I feel more alert. And that is because of the effect of these acetylcholine receptors on the brain. I know I'm not saying please smoke. I mean, I'm saying please don't smoke because, you know, smoking, of course, has many other very harmful effects on the body. But if you were to look at the particular effect on the brain itself, you know, it has this, it can directly influence specific populations of neurons. But whether or not long term it's useful for the brain, that is difficult to say.
The fact that we are all overweight, diabetic, does that affect the brain in any way?
Yeah, I mean, if you think of sort of if our overall health is not good, then that will also have a knock-on effect on our brain health. So, for example, if you are obese or if you are generally unhealthy, you know, that can cause, say, inflammation in the brain. So, for example, if you're, there's a theory known as the gut microbiome, meaning that if your gut is not happy, that has a knock-on effect on your brain health. And so the brain, you have a lot more inflammation in the brain. And so the inflammation then will attack the neurons and cause them to be damaged. So if you were obese, then perhaps the impact on the gut and on your blood sugar levels, you know, for example, that will have a knock-on effect on the health of the neurons as well.
Okay, so lifestyle,
terribly important.
Let's move on to this study and how memories associate with emotions. As you said, as far as possible, my takeaway from this is make every experience pleasurable, because that will affect
pleasure. Yes,
how you
pleasurable would be a good thing. Or you can make every experience, you know, have an emotional
connection with it. Pleasurable emotion. So what about bad memories, and do they trigger anxiety and post-traumatic stress disorder?
Yes, I mean, I think the recent study, we have to kind of look at it from the sense that a lot of the media headlines is that, you know, you can erase bad memories without actually clearly explaining what the study is really trying to do. So if you look at the media headlines, like I said, it seems almost frivolous in the sense that, you know, any bad memory is worth erasing. For example, you know, memories of an ex or memories of, you know, the end of a movie even, you know, so that you can enjoy that movie or book all the time, or the memory of a horrible experience at a restaurant, or for example. But actually, the research that they're doing is for to look at erasing memories that cause debilitating conditions whereby you cannot leave the house, you starve yourself because you have associated something bad with food. So, you know, certain, you know, very severe phobias and very life-changing, debilitating, stressful events that cause great anxiety, not these sort of, you know, bad memories that are so-called manageable. And actually, we wouldn't really want to erase all our bad memories, right? Because bad memories actually help us to learn and
be stronger.
That's right. And to adapt and to know which restaurant not to go back to next time, right? So, and actually, I should say that there's a really good movie, and I'm sure a lot of people have watched it, called Inside Out. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, well, you should. It's fantastic. It's an animation. And it's basically talking about, you know, memories and having bad memories and how having some bad memories will help you kind of get stronger and to help you with getting over certain events in life by learning, you know.
Make you more resilient.
Make you more resilient. So if anybody is sort of looking for a movie for movie night, you know, look out for Inside Out.
Yeah. I'll remember that. Mm. So what these scientists did is they analyzed neurons from a marine snail to test this hypothesis explaining why memories of incidents surrounding a bad experience can themselves trigger anxiety. Snail, Dr. Aslina? I mean, how close are we in the makeup of a snail?
Yes. So, well, the reason why they chose a snail was because actually the very first experiments looking at memory formation was in a snail, and these marine snails called the aplysia. So Eric Kandel, who was a neuroscientist who first described changes in the synapse that can be part of this memory formation, actually did these experiments in the snails. So it kind of makes sense that, you know, you kind of go back to it. But not only that, these snails, we know now that a lot of the kind of molecular makeup that you can find in the snail is also present in humans. So, for example, you know, they also release serotonin, which we have, of course. They have certain channels, ion channels in their brain that allow sodium ions in and potassium ions. Same channels in the humans. They have certain receptors, NMDA receptors, AMPA receptors. We have that too. So
I will never look at the garden snail the same way again.
Yeah. So
I always think of them as pets. My God, they have a brain.
Yeah. Oh, of course. And the other thing is that because if you wanted to study something so complex as memory, if you were to use a human, I mean, you have so many combinations to think about. But how they studied in the snail is that they actually kind of use a very simple system. And so if you can kind of map out that this neuron is going to talk to this other neuron, and I know for sure that those are the only connections that these two neurons are making, then it's easier then to manipulate. Whereas if you were to do that in a human, you know, it's very difficult to just isolate one or two neurons that are only talking to each other. You know, you can't ignore all the other connections that they're also getting, right? Whereas in the snail, it's easy to map out exactly the connections. And so then you can target them easier.
So what exactly did they do?
Okay, so for the for the snail, what they did was, for them, they used a particular drug. So what they did was they used the anatomy of a snail, right? And so the snail has something called a siphon, which is like a very soft piece of tissue that sticks out of its body, and it has a gill. And so every time the siphon is touched or senses pressure, it will withdraw the gill, right? I didn't know I was going to be telling you about snail anatomy today, but
but it makes sense. We've watched them in action.
Yes, so. And then they also have a tail. So what you can do is that you can actually teach the snail to kind of associate certain things with a pinch on the tail, or in this case, normally they do an electric shock, a mild electric shock to the tail, and you sort of look at how it responds by withdrawing the gill. So what they did was that they taught the snail to associate electric shock to the tail with withdrawing the gill, and then they were able to map out which neurons are responsible for that. And then they found, very interestingly, that depending on what type of stimulation you give, different proteins are involved. And so then they then tested the theory in that if you blocked the activity of one of these proteins, could you erase the memory of the tail shock, for example? And so they found that they could. And so that was a very simple it sounds simple, but it must have technically been quite difficult to do, because they also grew the neurons out in a dish to kind of also test it outside the body to see whether or not their theory was correct. So in that sense, they were able to erase the memory. So they had taught the snail to associate a tail shock with a particular event. And then when they blocked the proteins that were responsible for forming this memory, the snail no longer behaved as if it remembered. And so that's how they were able to erase a memory. But they've also done it in mice recently, another group at MIT. And they've been involved in a number of different experiments where they, in terms of memory, they make it, they erase it, and they can fake it. Yeah. So they wow. formed a false memory. So, and this was really interesting. So you can actually train mice to be afraid of a particular environment. And how you do that is you normally put it in a box, and at the bottom, the floor of the box, you have a wire grid that you can put a mild electricity through it. So the mouse has a mild electric shock. And so you can kind of train the mouse to sort of fear that box. So what they did was that they put the mouse in, say, box A, and then they activated the memory of box A, right? So they made sure that the mouse could remember box A, so to speak. And then they moved the mouse to a completely different box, box B. And then that's when they gave the mouse the electric shock. But while they were giving the mouse the electric shock in box B, they made it recall box A. So it kind of associated the electric shock with box A, whereas we never gave the electric shock in box A, right? Nothing bad happened to it in box A. And then you can see whether the mice, when they are afraid, they don't move, they freeze. So they looked at the freezing behavior of these mice. And so then when they, after they had sort of created this memory whereby box A and electric shock, right? Then they moved the mouse back to box A, and they wanted to see, well, how is it going to behave now? And how do you think it behaved?
The same.
So it froze. Yeah, as if box A was also harmful. So that's what they mean by they had created a false memory. So actually, there was nothing wrong with box A.
Right.
Nothing ever happened to it in box A.
Mm-hmm.
But when they were in a separate box B, they associated
the box
A with this electric shock, right, by stimulating these neurons at the same time using this technique called optogenetics.
So it was the environment?
So when they came back to box A, they recognized it as box A, but they had created a false memory that box A was harmful.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I meant by that recently this was published. To show that, you can kind of even create false memories. So, of course, you can imagine the media went crazy, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
So many ethical issues involved in that one. But we'll come back and find out how all of this applies to the human and whether or not it's going to be that simple up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Mira Sivasodi. It's our Health and Living segment. Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, a neurogeneticist, in the studio with me. It's our 9th episode of Brainwaves. We're discussing memory editing based on research coming out of the US on snails. And Dr. Azlina also spoke about the mice and how you can actually fake memory and induce stuff which the brain
make it, erase it. Or fake it.
Sounds terribly scary,
yeah.
But that just shows the extent of the brain, isn't it, and what you can actually do with it. But then the human brain is so complex, Dr. Azlina. Can you actually just replicate a study like that for the human?
It's known that humans do form these false memories or false association of a memory. So one of the authors of the paper, an example that he gives is if you were robbed, right, at night in a dark alley, and you so happen to see, as you were being robbed, there's a red post box in one corner of that alley. So of course the memory of the very bad memory of being robbed will stay with you. But then some people also associate the now a red postbox, right? And so then every time they see this red postbox, they would then associate a red postbox, or it would trigger, you know, painful event. And you know, there have been many cases whereby witnesses have sort of given false testimonies. They said that they saw this person at a crime scene when actually, you know, then that person was nowhere there. The brain does form these sort of false memories on its own. And that's just shows how complex the memory formation.
Why does it do it though?
So, I mean, it kind of depends on, like I said, sometimes you're going through a very emotional event. And so the brain is sort of perhaps trying to make sense of that event. And so, you know, it wants to maybe somehow pick up clues on things that maybe I should avoid in the future. But sometimes it kind of associates something which is, you know, completely not harmful, like this red postbox. Doesn't mean every time you see a red postbox, it's going to, you're going to get robbed, right? Perhaps you want to form a memory that don't go down a dark alley, you know, that would be a good memory mm-hmm. to form. But a kind of disruptive, what they call non-associative memory of a postbox, which wasn't directly related to that event, would be harmful to you because, you know, you would develop a serious phobia. Those phobias can get greater and greater, and you can then start to worry about many other things which actually have no real harmful effect on your well-being.
So that's what this research is actually doing. Mm. So how do you erase that red post box from your memory? Can you actually do that?
Yeah.
This so-called non-associative memory.
Yeah. So I guess in humans, you can do it through therapy. You know, they do what they call that, like on TV, you know, you have this, you introduce that person to the red post box and, you know, you repeatedly kind of reintroduce them, expose them to it, make them confront it, and make them sort of learn that actually red post boxes are fine because they have to now form a different type of memory with the red post box to now, you know, override the original one. So that sort of psychological therapy is possible to be done in humans. But whether or not it's possible to kind of, you know, start implanting these electrodes in our brains and to erase those associations, that would be really hard because what the research that they've done in the mice is that, you know, you know exactly what is the stimulus that you're giving to the animal to cause it to develop this sort of fear. But in humans, you know, there are many things that can happen that you kind of pick on something fairly random. And so then if you were to try to manipulate that in the brain, how would you know out of the 1,000 random things that could have been in the dark alleyway that you would have chosen a red postbox? So it would be a little bit tricky to kind of do that in humans, but I imagine using this information, it might help in kind of developing some therapies to modify our behavior, you know, just as how the psychologists do now.
Behavioral therapy.
Right. Yeah.
So no chance of blocking the proteins?
Well, you could potentially, but to do it in humans, it's not as simple as taking a drug orally because then, you know, that protein that was involved in forming a bad memory could also be involved in forming all the other types of memories in your brain. So if you were to take that drug, you know, it would potentially affect you in a wider way than you want it to. I mean, how the researchers have been able to do it in the mice, particularly, is that, you know, you can specifically target the particular neurons using this laser beam, you know, using these sort of genetically engineered neurons. So you can target them directly. At the moment, of course, that's not possible to be done in humans.
Humans, okay. But is there any chance that the results of this sort of research could possibly be used to strengthen our memory?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think particularly the snail study that was just published by a group in Columbia University, they found these sort of new proteins that were involved. And so if you kind of identify new proteins, and that gives you a clearer idea of what are the processes that happen in the neurons. So then that would potentially give you a new avenue for targeting drugs, etc., you know, to come up with this magic pill that would help you with memory. But this, you know, memory is really complex, actually. And to develop a single pill that will help you so that you don't have to, you know, cram or study hard, you know, I'm sorry to say that's probably not.
Yes, the conclusion, no easy way out.
Yeah. Sorry, SPM students. Yeah.
What do you think will be the next steps for the researchers in the US from the snail study? Where do you think they'll go with this?
Well, they'll probably try and what we call higher animals, higher organisms. So meaning they'll probably move from mice to monkeys. And
the ones with more complex brains.
Yes, yes. And to try to see, they will probably try to do different manipulations of creating false memories and perhaps explore some of the emotional angles of why, if you are emotionally connected to that particular episode, that's so strong, you know, and so perhaps they will kind of try to manipulate those sort of connections a little bit more, because at the moment they've just looked at fear, but, you know, perhaps they want to look at reward systems so that later they can look at, you know, when you have addictive behaviors, can you modify the fact that you can... Why do people become so addicted to something? Is because they formed a memory that particular thing is hugely pleasurable. Mm-hmm. And so if you can manipulate that, then you can perhaps, it would be easier to sort of wean people from their addiction easier.
So what would be your advice for those of us who struggle with bad memory?
You have to, like I said, you know,
work
you have
those
to care.
Neurons.
You have to care. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if there's an event or if there's something that you need to remember, you need to obviously pay attention to it too. And by paying attention is also attaching a sort of emotional content to it or a reward content to it. Or, you know, so you have to, you know, memory, what we do know about memory is that actually the more input that you're getting in these cluster of neurons, the greater the strength of that memory. So if you don't pay attention, you don't care, and you don't repeatedly kind of go over it, then that will cause you, that memory not to be so well stored. But then if you kind of if number one, you pay attention, and number two, you care about wanting to know that information, right? Then that will help these synapses to form more easily.
Fantastic. Hard work, but can be done.
Yeah, there's no easy shortcut,
absolutely,
I'm afraid.
Absolutely not. Okay. That was Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, neurogeneticist on Brainwaves, discussing memory editing on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.